If you've listened to my podcast for a while, then you'll know that I have something of a colourful past with real estate investment, having built a sizable portfolio in the noughties, only to lose it all during the GFC and my subsequent messy divorce. So today we're going to hear from someone who I really wish I'd known back then. His name is Michael Yardney, and as one of the top real estate investment advisors in the world, I know I wouldn't have lost my lunch back in 09 if I'd had him on speed dial back then. G'day, it's Peter, and welcome to Office Anywhere, a conversation about working and living on purpose, whether that's working from home, walking your kids to school each day, or making a real dent in the universe. We talk about the stuff that matters versus shiny object syndrome, progress instead of perfection, and ultimately scaling your mountain to a life lived on your terms. After all, you only get one of them, right? If you want to earn your freedom and become who you really are, then begin with a free Work Anywhere trial guide at officeanywhere.co. That'll get you started. Then subscribe to this podcast for more ideas to live and work on purpose. Now, I've known Michael for about 8 years and have worked with him on repairing my past mistakes for the last few years. And thanks to his sober advice, I managed to crawl out of that abyss, and I'm now well placed to rebuild my portfolio and keep it this time. Now, one thing that a lot of you will have recognize that I preach is the critical importance of seeking counsel from those who've actually achieved what you're setting out to do. It's all too common for people to ask their friends, their neighbors, their relatives, what should I do in this situation? Or they read a couple of blog posts here and there. But in the world of investing especially, it's really critically important that the people that you seek counsel from, that you seek advice from, have actually accumulated their success. Number one, they've actually succeeded doing what you want to do. But number two, equally importantly, is that they've accumulated their success over multiple decades and multiple economic cycles. This is really important because, you know, even a stopped clock is correct twice a day. And, you know, when in boom times, it's easy to make money. So you want someone who's done it consistently and weathered the storms over a number of cycles. So with more than 40 years under his belt, Michael has really seen it all. And his sound advice has been like an elixir to the conflicting messages that the mainstream media is so good at pushing out there. Through his firm, Metropole Property Group, and his podcast, his best-selling books, his website, and his outstanding property update newsletter, Michael helps first-time and seasoned property investors navigate the shark-infested waters so they can create wealth for themselves and for their families. So, Michael, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the Office Anywhere podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, and that was a great introduction. If my mother was still alive, she'd be so proud of me with what you said.
And the beautiful thing is I've only covered a fraction of what you've accomplished and what you're known for. There's a lot of things I could say about you, but then the intro would be 80% of the interview and we'd only get to talk for 20% of it. So, Michael, look, something that I really love and admire about the advice that you dispense is that it's frightfully consistent and it's always cool-headed. Oftentimes I'll hear about something in the news cycle, in the mainstream news cycle, and I'll jump into your newsletter and inevitably you have addressed it, and it's always with a cool head, and I'm always impressed by just how consistently you respond to these kinds of machinations in the marketplace. You know, in the past, like a lot of other people, I was susceptible to the risky and always, you know, supposedly urgent advice of self-proclaimed gurus. And we've had a number of them here in Australia, as have people in the US and elsewhere. And, you know, I always feel like the advice I get from you is the exact opposite of the kind of stuff these people promulgate. I kind of liken it to, it's a sort of advice that you'd get from a kindly grandfather who's, you know, kind of crusty and a bit bad-tempered, but, you know, he has no time for speculators or bullshitters. But he will generously advise anyone who has the patience and the integrity to do things the right way. And that's what I really like about you. It's one of many things I like about you. So, you know, one thing that often comes to mind for me is, how hard has it been for you swimming against all of the get-rich-quick, boom-or-bust mentality of so many people out there, especially now with what's going on?
Well, it started by me needing to do it for myself. But in the 1990s, when I'd gone through my divorce and working out what I was going to do the rest of my life, the next stage of my life, a good friend of mine and one of my mentors said, Michael, you're going to become rich if you help other people do well and become rich as well. You've been very successful in this area of your life, in property investment, property development at that stage. And so I started to educate and teach people about what I was doing. And that was in the early days of the internet. And so around the year 2000, I did my first little seminar and I was on some internet forums. And even at that time, there were people with contrary views. What do you know? I guess today they're called trolls. So it was difficult, but basically my aim was to educate people and to share. I figured that once you got to a particular level of wealth, part of my responsibility was to help others as well, because I don't see it as a zero-sum game. Peter, if I buy an investment property, it doesn't stop you from getting one. I actually would rather make more Australians wealthy and help improve our communal wealth and the beauty of our country, rather than knock other people. So rather than try to take advantage in the short term, I think it's because I've always had a long-term perspective, rather than get rich quick and all these other people are into the latest fads, I've tried to keep a level head. I haven't always been right, but I've been right more than I've been wrong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And every time I see, you know, headlines in mainstream media about property prices are going to plummet 30% and all this sort of stuff, and, you know, it's going to be disaster for the next 5 years, I always have to smirk to myself, because I just know that almost inevitably and almost invariably they're going to be proven wrong, and you will be the one who is brave enough to call it for what it really is, you know?
Well, I'm in my late 60s now, and I bought my first investment property in my early 20s. So it's close to 50 years experience. And with that comes perspective. Now, I know some people do the same thing 50 years in a row. I think over the years I've grown, though, and I've changed. And some things don't change, though. So what I'm able to give, as you mentioned earlier on, is that grey-haired perspective of a grandfather. Some people call me the elder statesman of Australian real estate. I've been around for a long time, and I take that public position. I've got the authority that people see in me very seriously. Got to do the right thing.
No, that's good. That's good. So what actually got you into real estate investing in the first place, and why are you so passionate about it as a means to build long-term wealth?
Well, I came as a migrant, son of migrant parents. I came to Australia at the age of 3. My parents were workers. They were good people. My father wasn't really educated. My mother worked as a clerk in the bank, and my father worked in hospitality for a long time. And my friends' parents were wealthier. My parents' friends, who happened to be my friends' parents, were wealthy. They went on holidays and we didn't. They had a car and we didn't. For the first 10 years of my life, 9 years of my life, we lived in the same house as my grandparents. My parents didn't have my sister till I was close to 9. Some people said it's because I put them off having more kids, but I think it was really because they just couldn't afford it. And I saw these other people who did and who could, and I learned that they owned real estate. The other thing early in my life, when we actually did buy our first home, was I was impressed by the estate agents who drove these big American cars in those days. They were called Yangtanks. Today, you know, the wealthy people drive the European cars. And I thought they were rich, the real estate agents. I didn't realize that they were probably leased cars then, and it was the people they were working for that were rich. But so from an early age, I wanted to be like those wealthy people, and I wanted to have it all. So to me, that's what initially inspired me, not what my parents were doing, but what my friends' parents were doing.
Yeah. Look, I had probably like you, some early inspiration that really spurred me on to want to become financially independent. My parents were very, very good with money in terms of how they saved it. And they never had a mortgage in their life. They built their first house literally around them, one room at a time. They lived in one room and the neighbors thought they were mad. But by the time the last window went in, they owned it all. So in that sense, they were good, but they were always too scared to invest. So one of my earliest influences was a fellow who was an art director that convinced me to leave my banking career and become a photographer for car magazines. And when I went to visit him in Mount Eliza, he had this beautiful big house. He had a pink marble garage with a black Ferrari in it. He had a huge bird aviary, a massive swimming pool, a mother of pearl wall, and all the cool furniture. And he had models coming over for photo shoots and everything. I thought, man, this is the life I want, you know? Bugger not having a mortgage. I want to have the big house and the black Ferrari and everything. So he kind of inspired me indirectly to want to become financially independent. Now, the trap, of course, for any young bloke who's full of testosterone and not much experience is that they can often make some critical errors when it comes to risk, who they seek advice from, and how quickly they expect to be able to get where they want to go. So I'm just curious, you know, whether you suffered any of these kinds of travails when you were younger. Did you have any, you know, particular flops in your early days, you know, becoming an investor or wanting to be an investor?
Not in the early days. And that was probably one of the challenges I faced, because if you get it right first time, Peter, you think you're smarter than you are. So I saved $1,000. I actually worked part-time while I was going to uni and worked at Portman's. They're still around, the ladies' fashion store in the stock room. And I saved some money, and my parents saved some money. And together we put $2,000 down on a property in Larch Street, South Caulfield. We paid $18,000 for it. I put $2,000 deposit. We took a 30-year loan for $16,000. We had no idea how we were going to pay for it. We got $12 a week rent. In those days, in the early 70s, the family car was a Kingswood, Holden Kingswood. It cost $2,000. But the Labor government came into power. Inflation happened. And all of a sudden, this property I bought went up in value. And the rent went up. And it went up so much, the bank actually allowed me to buy a second property a couple of years later. So I thought, hey, this is really, really good. Now, I made all the mistakes. I bought right near where we lived, near where we went to school, near where my mother went shopping. I was still living at home with my parents at the time. But I just happened to luck out. So it took a while till the first recession that I experienced in the 1980s. So I actually had a good run initially. Of course, my greed got the better of me, and I have made a lot of mistakes along the way. As I learned, I've fallen over more often than most. I'm a real success at failure, but I've gotten up every time. I think one of the things is my resilience.
Yeah, look, I relate to that. I also had a very good run early, which gave me a false sense of security or a false sense of superiority, really. You know, I bought a place just as the property market was booming, and, you know, it grew in value very, very rapidly. I picked up a very stylish non-decazzolitis apartment in the city with two car parks and a 16-square terrace, and it just shot up in value. And then I sold the extra car park for a really good sum. And almost from day one, it was cash flow positive. And I had enough equity in there within 12 months to go and buy a brand new Mercedes and stick that on the equity and stuff. And I thought, I can't possibly lose, you know. But of course, reality came to bite me in the ass, and I overstretched. I was in a rush. And in the end, thanks to the GFC, I lost the whole lot, and well, most of it, and then my divorce took care of the rest of it.
Yes, that asset reallocation program that we've both had.
Yeah. But, you know, it taught me some valuable lessons, and a lot of it I deserved, I think, because I was just, you know, overconfident and too impatient. So
you're not alone. I was in my 20s, a friend of mine invested in a gold mine. He had somebody come around to his place and took, and I can't remember, I think it was $5,000. And that was a lot of money in those days, probably equivalent to $50,000. And I said to him, how stupid can you be, Brian? This is a scam. And he said, no, you've got to listen to this guy. And this fellow came around, and it was on a Sunday, to our house and sat at our dining room table, and he took a nugget of gold out of his pocket. And he told me about Wedderburn in Ballarat area, and it was Asian Pacific Mining Corporation was the name of his company. I even remember his name. I'm not going to say it now. And he gave a really good story, and he said, look, this could be yours. You could be part of this. The new technology was now going to be able to open up all those old mines. There was going to be lots of money. And he told me of the other people that were investing. So I gave him $5,000 of our money as well. And it all got spent on him. He lived in a fancy house in Toorak, but in those days you couldn't actually do Google searches or things like that. So he had an investors meeting there, and there were some impressive people there. And I got sucked into a get-rich-quick scheme. I soon learned that not everything that glistens is gold. It hurt my ego considerably. I had to explain to my wife how I wasted, thrown away such a large amount of my money. It was eventually looked into by, I don't think ASIC was even around then, but the federal police who had to give a statement. Don't know whatever happened to this guy. But it was one of the best lessons I learned also about doing due diligence, about not believing everything that I was told. And there's no get-rich-quick schemes. There's no shortcuts.
No, absolutely. And anybody who's trying to convince you of the merits of an investment, if they have a vested interest in you deciding to do it, then that has always got to be a red flag. When it comes to advice, you really want the advice to be independent. You want to pay the person for their expertise and their advice. I think that's important that you do that. I think free advice can be very expensive. So I advocate paying for good quality advice from people who've done what you're seeking to do, but not for them to benefit financially should you decide to go with what they recommend, or not for them to benefit disproportionately from one recommendation to another.
Yep.
So that's really important. I was going to ask you about, you know, any particularly spectacular investments that you've had where you've either lucked into something or you've changed your approach, you've taken a unique approach and something has worked out really well for you. Do you have any stories around that kind of thing?
Maybe it's not what you're expecting, but I learned the importance of investing in myself along the way. So I think, like you, being young and with testosterone and thinking I was smarter than other people and having some success at the beginning, I did okay. And then it was really the recession we had to have in the early 1990s, where a number of my friends went bankrupt. A couple of people I was doing property developments with had overcommitted themselves, and I managed to get through that. But at that stage, I really didn't have many mentors. It was harder in those days. Locally, it was difficult. There wasn't the internet. There were books. There were very few real estate books in Australia. There were success books from overseas. I used to listen to tape sets. But when I actually started to understand the importance of personal development and having mentors, and I guess not being arrogant enough to think I could do it on my own or do it better than somebody who'd already achieved what I wanted to achieve. In fact, that was probably my best investment, Peter. It was the biggest one because it was an investment into my mindset. I thought it was knowledge that was important, and so I was hungry for knowledge and kept reading. It actually wasn't knowledge. It's actually the implementation of it, which really has to do with one's mindset. And I started to understand then about behavioral finance, about psychology of success, and that made all the rest work beautifully, and I grew my wealth and my happiness in leaps and bounds.
That makes a lot of sense. And so often I've been guilty of exactly the same thing, consuming more and more and more information, believing that that's the answer, and it just isn't. If anything, it just clouds your judgment more and confuses you more and just creates anxiety. I truly believe, as you do, that it comes down to, it's a lot like what Charlie Tremendous Jones said. I often refer to this Charlie Tremendous Jones bloke, a guy, that big, loud American motivational speaker that I saw a number of times speak on stage here. But he used to really advocate for reading, but he would say, never read to be smart. Don't read to be clever. Read to actually unlearn a lot of things. Read to simplify. Read to be a simpler, clearer thinker. And never read too much. Read just enough to stay hungry for more, you know? And I agree with you that once you get the way you think and the way you disseminate information right, you don't need anywhere near as much information to make good decisions. And when it comes to expertise, oftentimes it's better to defer to somebody who's got the decades of expertise than for you to try and catch up in a year, you know?
That's a good point, Peter, because basically when you start off in anything, whether it's property investment or any business or industry, there seem like a million things you need to know, when in general there's probably only three or four major principles you need to understand. But the challenge is understanding and putting a perspective to it. So I know people go to courses. I remember somebody rang me a client who went to somebody else's course and said, I've actually got a checklist. I've actually got this checklist, and I've been told, I paid for it, but I've been told that if I follow this checklist, I'm going to be really successful. I'll be successful as a property developer. And I said, no, you won't. You know me, Peter, I'm a little bit blunt.
Yeah.
And he said, I don't understand. I said, there's one thing missing from that checklist. And I was silent. And he added to eventually ask, what is it? And I said, perspective. If you've got a checklist of everything, then if everything's important, nothing's important. So what I had to learn with years, and we all have to learn that from our failures, but also from our mentors, is the perspective. So, yes, information is useful, but there's probably only a small amount of that that you really need to be able to move forward. Others think they need
to know it all. Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. I often say that it's pointless trying to copy your mentors, because the process that they followed that because it's unique to them, their personality, their perspective, their history up to that moment, the leverage they have, the influence they have, the contacts they have. There are so many variables that just mimicking your mentors is pointless. You're better off leveraging your mentors and using them for very specific advice for specific circumstances, not just copying a playbook.
Yeah.
Copying playbooks is dangerous. So you mentioned there that, you know, there's only really a handful of things that are important. So, you know, what are, in your view, the golden unbreakable rules for investing to build wealth?
Well, I believe in Australia, where most of the people listening to this podcast are, in the developed world, everyone has the ability to become wealthy. Pam and I had the fortune just before we were all locked down with coronavirus to do a 6-week cruise, and we did it in the West, amongst other places we visited, was the west coast of Africa and some very, very poor underdeveloped countries. And I can't see how people there are going to become wealthy. Despite having knowledge, the opportunities aren't there. The only way they seem to be, unfortunately, is through corruption and crime, and that's not good. But I think where people are listening to this, there is the opportunity. And when I see clients, when I have people in my mentorship program, when I deal with other business people, you'll hear that it actually doesn't, wealth, success doesn't discriminate. So there's people who've come from migrant backgrounds, people who are born here, people who finished university, and people who haven't, people who inherited a bit of wealth, but most are actually self-made millionaires. So I guess the first thing to understand is where we live, anyone can become wealthy and successful. And again, they're probably, what's the definition of wealth and success? Maybe I should quickly say mine is, it's got nothing to do with money, but it used to, Peter. So to me, I used to chase money. My parents were poor. They used to fight about money. The money never made it to the end of the month. And so I said to myself, I was never going to be like that. So chasing money for anger, which it was in my case, not to be like them. I rebelled. It didn't work for me. It helped me ruin my first marriage. Having said that, true wealth to me is having money, but the ability to appreciate and enjoy it. You need somebody to love and somebody to love you. You need your health. You need time to be able to appreciate your money. You should be able to grow and learn. So it's money plus all those things, plus the ability to contribute back to the community. So when you asked about building wealth, wealth isn't just money, even though I've been speaking a little bit about money. But if you're talking about the money side of wealth, so maybe the other side of wealth is gratitude. So how do you build wealth? You've got to be grateful. If you're not grateful, you can have all the money, you can have all the rest, not worth it. If we talk about the money side, you've got to spend less than you earn. So you've got to become valuable. You've got to learn a craft, a skill. It doesn't have to be university where you actually earn money. You spend less than you earn. You invest it. There's nothing new about this, Peter. You save it, you invest it, and then you repeat yourself. And one way to do it is, an important part of it is delayed gratification. So on the money side, that's how you do it. On the real wealth, the true wealth, which is what you're left with when they take all the rest away, and you've been there and I've been there, when that happens, it actually has nothing to do with the money or your cars or your stock portfolio, does it, Pete?
No, absolutely not. Yeah, you know, as many times as we try to return to the secrets to wealth, and I hate it when people use secrets because, like you said, it's not a secret. It's not anything new. It hasn't really change. The principles will always be the principles, and that's why they're called principles, because it is fundamentally simple. And the biggest roadblock to it, 99 times out of 100, of course, is the grey matter between the ears of the person wanting to be wealthy, isn't it?
So I believe that we all have a wealth operating system, a thermostat inside. And if you took all the money in the world and distributed it evenly in, I don't know, 4 or 5 years' time, it'd be back into the same proportion again. So when I've now, having mentored over 2,500 people over the last 15, 16 years, I can reasonably soon, within 4 or 5 minutes of speaking to them, know what level of wealth they're going to achieve. And it really, as you said a minute ago, it all has to do with what's in their head. It's their wealth operating system, what they're programmed for. And the level of wealth most people will have got today is where they're most comfortable with. Because I've just found over and over again, people sabotage themselves, as I did in the first half of my life. And I've seen a lot of other very successful business people and entrepreneurs reach a certain level and then they lose it. Now, most entrepreneurs have lost it along the way. In fact, if you haven't gone broke once, you've not really tried too hard. But that's a different thing. They lose it, but they come back again. Other people just stay at the same level and they don't get to the next level of money, of wealth.
Mm. I guess this is why 95% of people who win over $1 million in lotteries end up worse off. They end up the same or worse off within 5 years, because if they had the right mindset to get $1 million, they wouldn't need to win it. They would have been on their way to earning it.
100%. Now, I've actually never seen anyone who's won $1 million in the lottery, but Peter, I've seen people who've inherited that and they do it the same. Mm. So that's
yeah,
like
same
winning
thing.
The lottery too. They spend it all and then they come to us when they've spent most of it and say, what do I do with the last 250,000 I'm left over with? Where's the other 750?
Yeah. Anyway. You must really want to just slap them when they come to you like that. Look, obviously, the success that you've had over the long term has created a wonderful life for you. You just mentioned that 6-week cruise with your wife. So, what has it done for you besides the ability to travel a bit and your family? I mean, I know that you still work hard and you do that by choice, as do most successful entrepreneurs, because it's no longer work. Once you've got your basic needs met and you're doing something that you love, that you care about, you keep going. So what has it done for you?
I guess it's given me choices, Peter. So, yes, I do still work hard and I do get up early, but I've balanced. So my day is not balanced day by day. In fact, not even week by week. So I'm up early and I get some stuff done before Pam gets up. When I used to go to the office before the locking down with COVID, I used to do an hour or two's work here too, the most productive time. But then I other times have long breaks. We take a 6-week, 8-week break at Christmas time, another vacation mid-year. So I jokingly say I conduct the orchestra and I have other people play the instruments. So I can now choose who I play with, what I do, when I do things. And that gives me the opportunity to see my children and my grandchildren very regularly, to live the lifestyle that I want. I still like my toys, Peter. I do, and I enjoy them. That's okay. Hey, I've learned delayed gratification. I waited 1.5 days before I bought the latest iPhone. I only waited a couple of days before I bought the new iPad, even though I got one. But I can do that now because I have built an asset base, so I don't have to worry like I used to before. And the other thing it's done is given me the ability to give my children and my grandchildren the type of lifestyle I would have liked to have. And it's also allowed Pam and me to give back to charities in the community, because I think that's very important too. So it's allowed me to have a wealthy life and a grateful life.
Mm, sounds wonderful. Yeah, look, there is an enormous sense of long-term pleasure to be had from giving through whether it's, traditional charities or through some other means. And I wrote an article about this a long time ago saying that, one of the most selfish things you can do is to be charitable, because we do it because it is, in terms of bang for buck, it is one of the best things that you can do for your own sense of purpose and joy and happiness and, completing that sort of circle of life thing that you've worked hard, you've had some knocks down, you've had some knocks, you've had some successes, and now you're going to feed back into that ecosystem, which is enormously satisfying. I wonder if I could talk to you about, before we get on to some other stuff, something a little bit more specific, how you think that this whole pandemic is now feeding into people's desire to build wealth independently. Because, of course, a lot of people now are facing financial instability. They're realizing that the promises that they were made by their employer about career progression and all this sort of stuff, through no fault of the employer, has now been thrown out the window. And a lot of them, I'm sure, are thinking, I really need some way to safeguard me and my family well into the future should we ever face this kind of thing again. So do you see this feeding into the kinds of people coming to you now, the kinds of inquiries you're getting now?
Well, I'm seeing three types of thinking amongst people at the moment. And it's not just potential investors, but it's business owners. And some are just worried about the here and now. So at the moment, as we're recording this, there is a little bit of a loosening of the restrictions, and people are starting to see light at the end of the tunnel. But Peter, I think we haven't heard a lot of the bad news yet. I think over the next little while, we're going to be getting more bad news about unemployment and about the recession eventually. And so a group of people are worried. They're thinking, oh, this is the end of the world. This is terrible. And for some people, where their incomes have disappeared, their jobs have disappeared, or their businesses have had to close down, I can understand why they're thinking that. And so what I try, well, maybe I should start with a slightly different thought, that there's a lot of uncertainty at the moment. And you can understand why, because nobody expected a pandemic to suddenly come and get us. The other things people expected, but this was out of the blue. So at a time of uncertainty, it's easy to be nervous, fearful. But if we give some certainty to it, in 12 months' time, we're going to be in May 2021, and there's a level of certainty. That's true. That is going to happen. And there's another certainty, Peter. Sometime between now and then, and I don't know exactly when it's going to be, could be in 6 weeks, could be in 6 months, we're going to cross what I'm calling a survival line. In other words, the fear and greed, the fear is going to be overtaken by greed. In other words, the desire to do more, to keep moving, to get going again is going to overtake the current fears. So between now and then, those people who are nervous, scared, wanting to sell up, close down their business, sack all their employees, not invest in property, they're not going to make it to the survival line. The majority of Australians are hunkering down. Okay, I buy all the spaghetti and pasta and in the old days toilet paper I need, and I'm just going to, I won't employ more people, I won't invest further, I'll just hunker down and I'll survive. And they will survive and they will cross that survival line, and in a year they will be in May 2021, but they will have missed out the opportunity that a small group of people are currently seeing, knowing that every recession, every economic downturn, every time there is an issue like this, there is opportunities at the other end once we cross that survival line. So a group of people are getting set. And interestingly, I'm seeing more people, business-wise, than ever, we're seeing more people inquire about our wealth advisory services. So what we do is we don't sell property, as you know, but we help people invest in property by giving strategic advice, whether it's wealth advice, financial planning advice, property plans. So there's a group of young people who've never been through all this before who are not approaching us anymore, the young people who weren't sore before, but we're seeing more people than ever who've been around a little bit, getting themselves set, not necessarily saying, let's buy something now, let me get my finances right now, let's get the structures, let me get a plan together so I know what I want to do. And so they're the ones who are going to take advantage of the opportunities, not of the people, but there will be opportunities when the time comes, as there already are in the market at the moment. And it's the same with business people, because part of what we do is a business coaching and mastermind program as well. And in that, we're seeing a lot of business people knowing that when they cross the line, there's going to be opportunities, because unfortunately other businesses have closed down. There'll be new staff, employees around, because other people have let them go. So different people are thinking differently, and they've got different thought processes, and that's going to show up in the results they get. So the people are going to not lose the opportunity that a crisis brings. So it's not taking advantage of the people, but of the opportunities. Those people are thinking differently. They're saying, hey, this is a reset. This is time now for me to get into the next opportunity.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, that's that often quoted line from Buffett that you so often remind us of, isn't it? Is to be fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful.
It's hard to do, though. It's hard to do emotionally. But the other interesting thing that Buffett's saying is when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked. And those people who bought properties off the plan and now can't settle, or bought in those Legoland high-rise towers built out of paper mache with all the structural problems, or the house and land packages in the outer suburbs, they're unfortunately suffering, because not all properties are going to go down in value, but some are at the moment. And that's a pity. So downturns like this are part of the economic cycle. It is part of the cleaning out of the cycle, and it's a necessary part of the economy moving forward.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I just got word from our finance broker a couple of days ago that he's had a few settlements where 2 days prior to settlement, the banks have wanted to have a recheck of capacity, financial capacity, serviceability of the applicant, of the the lender, the borrower, and found that they've gone on to, you know, some sort of government assistance temporarily during this thing, and they've pulled it out from under them and said, sorry, we're not going to let you settle, you know, and then they've lost their deposit or their deposit is at risk, you know. So, yeah, it's certainly been tricky for some who have not been properly prepared. And I know that when you and I spoke, you, me and my wife, about preparing for our next purchase, which I think will be back on the cards very soon now that things look to be a little bit more predictable, is you went to great lengths to ensure that we actually did a fair bit of preparation beforehand, that we had to have a very clear picture of our financial situation, our serviceability, our capacity going forward, the structure that we had set up, all this sort of stuff. So it was very much a case of, you know, measure twice, cut once. And that's so important. A lot of people who are, you know, panicking now are going to forget that important principle, that you need to still take the time to prepare properly before you jump in. So let's talk a little bit more about now. Sorry, if there's anything else you wanted to add to that, Michael?
Oh, I think even if, look, unemployment's going to get to 10%. Having said that, real unemployment or underemployment, to be blunt, is going to be closer to 20%. ABS figures are always short. Having said that, 80% of people still have got jobs. People are still getting married. People are still getting, unfortunately, divorced. They're having babies. Life's moving on. Some are getting wealthier during these times as well. So if you've got a secure job and if you are financially set up, this is a window of opportunity for those people interested in real estate to take advantage of a time when the only people who are selling at the moment are discretionary. Not, I apologise, the only people who are selling at the moment are non-discretionary sellers, people who maybe bought a house who now have to sell their other one or for other reasons selling, but you wouldn't put your house on the market at the moment if you didn't have to. And so there are some good properties still available. There's a shortage of stock, but if you're well set up, it's not a bad time at all to get into the market now, because when you look back in 6 months' time, 9 months' time, you're going to think, hey, that was a good buy. Yeah, well, if you call, only if you buy the right property, of course.
Of course, yeah. Look, I know you often say that only 5% of properties are investment grade, and I've studied your charts too that that you pulled from you know, government sources showing how minimal the impact on long-term property growth is during major upheavals in the financial markets, and it was quite sobering to see that. It's very easy to you know, panic and say the sky is falling, but you know, if you're not over leveraged in the stock market, for example, and you can just hang on to your stock and you have this, you can service your real estate rides through these kinds of crises very well. I don't want to take up too much of your time, Michael, because I, you know, like I said, we could chat forever and we're already 40 minutes in. So I want to talk to you a little bit more about, you know, the current work from home situation. You mentioned when we started that you're kind of enjoying working from your Bayside home there down in Brighton. So what's it been like for you, not doing the usual routine of going to the office each morning?
My office is 2 minutes away from home in the car. I really could walk it, but I don't. I've actually set up a good routine at home, so I'm disciplined and I'm doing the same thing. I've been busier than ever. I mean, actually enjoying it. In the past, I used to work from home 1 or 2 days a week anyway, because that was the time that I felt creative. But I felt I had to be there, to be blunt, more to show myself to the staff, even though I had other people managing people. So I was managing managers, and I can do this now by Zoom. One of the things I found interesting, Peter, is it's tiring. And I've since read that having multiple Zoom meetings actually takes more of your brain work to stay engaged. So I'm getting a lot more done. I'm enjoying it. And it's the cats are wondering, well, see, we don't have any dogs. My kids have got dogs, and their dogs are probably thinking, hey, this is fantastic. My owners are home with me all day. They must love me. And my cats are wondering, what's he doing home all day? He's probably a loser like I always thought he was. He isn't at work anymore.
Yeah. Cats are such different animals to dogs, aren't they? It's like they say, you know, if you really want to know who loves you more, you know, lock your wife in the boot of your car for an hour and then do the same to your dog and see which one's happy to see you when you open them.
That's right.
So tell me, with your team now distributed out working from home as well, what sort of tools are you using to help manage your team and your projects and your advisors? Because you've got a lot of moving parts in your business. So how are you doing that?
Well, we've got 60 team members based in Melbourne, Sydney and Brisbane. And they're all working remotely. Having said that, there's a few people who are still coming into the office, and that each of the divisions works differently. So they're still busy. So we have a very large property management division. We look after people's investment properties. We look after close to $2 billion worth of assets in on behalf of our clients. So, for example, for property management, the regulations and the rules are changing on a daily basis. And on that basis, they've got to speak to landlords, they've got to speak to tenants, they've got to try and appease people. So some of them are still going out, doing open for inspections, renting properties. People are still renting, but they've got to go to the office for some paperwork. But fortunately, most of our information systems are in the cloud. In fact, they all are. So on that basis, people can work from home. Our buyer's agents are still buying investment properties for clients. We've been very busy, but it's harder for them to do things. Administrative people, I think they're enjoying working from home, and the accounting and other people are able to do that quite easily. So we have a number of programs that we use. Almost everything is cloud-based anyway. People are able to log into their computers from home. We had set all that up in anticipation because some people were already doing it, but as we perceived this was going to happen, we prepared quickly, and fortunately it has meant that some are working a bit harder, but we're functioning well.
That's good. So do you see that there'll be a situation in the months ahead where some of them will either A, not need to go back, they can continue to function just as well from home, or that they won't want to go back?
So we have for quite some time allowed many of our team to work one day a week from home for their convenience. And as a business owner, I think an element of it also was being able to trust them to do that. And I think that has now been proven. I know there's a lot who are in the other way around, looking forward to coming back to the office. So I was just speaking to one of our team a couple of days ago who has recently moved down to Melbourne from Bendigo, and he said, I didn't sign up for this working from home, but he knew he would have had to do that in Bendigo as well. So there's some of the younger team members who are feeling isolated. They don't have family members, or if they do, they've got flatmates there. It's not the same. So some really still want the camaraderie. Having said that, we've tried to keep it, Peter. So what we're doing is we've set up a WhatsApp group, which we didn't have before, and people are sending little memes, funny jokes to actually make people – I initially thought we'd be doing it for notifications, but it very soon changed to a social group where people are learning more about each other and their sense of humours, et cetera. So that's been good. Every couple of weeks on a Friday afternoon, we have virtual drinks on Zoom where I've found it important to give a message of explaining what's going on, telling people what's going to happen in the future. So it's been really important to do this, but to keep communicating with them. And by communicating, it's not picking up the phone. That's the quick, easy way. It's actually to get onto a visual program like Zoom and actually look at them face to face and keep the connection. So I'm doing it with a level of management, and it's their job to do it with their various teams, but then once a fortnight or so. I think it's important to lead and for people to have a sense of comfort that I'm pointing us all in the right direction. I take it seriously that their livelihoods, their futures are dependent upon me. So giving them a sense of comfort that they've got their jobs.
You know, one thing I like about what this pandemic has done is it has revealed people for the human beings that they are. It's a bit like wealth. You know, wealth doesn't change people. It reveals people. And I think that a crisis like this also has the same effect, that it reveals the humanity in people as it strips away the visual cues of hierarchy within a traditional office setting where the suits are gone, the status roles are diminished to an extent, and it comes down to human beings actually wanting to work together and achieve things together and do good work. And those who come in with that mindset, I think, are really prospering or growing as human beings during this crisis. It's really good to see this, how this is revealing that kind of thing about people. My 19-year-old daughter actually shared something with me a little while ago. I might be able to pull it up while we're chatting about something else, that was just a brilliant little bit of text about what this is doing. But we'll move on because time's running against us. So let's talk a little bit about, some of the principles that you adhere to. You've written enough material about wealth principles and mindset. We've talked quite a bit about it. You've written enough about this that you could wallpaper every house in Australia, I reckon. So as someone who others look to, myself included, for wisdom and for guidance, who do you turn to? Who are your heroes and why are they your heroes?
They've changed over time. So I learned from different people in different areas, and I actually only again this year took on another business coach. I've had business coaches all along. So is a business coach a hero? I've actually recently learned a lot from Simon Bowen, who's based in Western Australia, teaching graphic and model ways of selling. So that's really very useful if we're now doing things remotely. And it's actually changing the way we're presenting our service offering to clients and showing the value of what we bring differently, because I believe we are able to bring a different depth of value. And so he's a role model. I've just recently been spending a lot of time with and investing. So I'm doing what I'm telling others to be doing, taking this opportunity to invest and actually take advantage of the opportunities that are moving on. I've also learned not just to read and speak to people who confirm my my assumptions and my beliefs. It's too easy today. If you start reading on Google or wherever, you'll go down that rabbit warren of it'll keep only bringing up things that you want to hear. So just last week, I interviewed for the Michael Yardney podcast Harry Dent, who believes the world is coming to an end. Well, not really, but he believes we're going to have such a terrible recession that the house prices are going to drop 40% and it's going to be Armageddon. Now, I listened to him and I gave him airtime, even though I didn't initially agree, and then I unpacked his thoughts and I spoke with another economist about that, and we presented that on the show. That's actually gone live the morning that we're recording your podcast. And the reason I'm prepared to listen to other people is maybe they're right. Now, my moment ago at the beginning of this show, you said some of these people are right twice a year, so he's picked 27 of the last two downturns. That's the problem, unfortunately. But sometimes you can learn from things. And then same day, interestingly, I spoke to Robert Kiyosaki, who
I saw that.
I learned a lot from him, and his team asked me to interview him on my podcast because he had a message he wanted to give to Australians, and I was very honoured that he allowed me to do that. And he doesn't believe your home in Australia is an asset. And so while I believe a lot of his financial principles, and I've learned a lot from him as of tens of millions of people, I'm also prepared to at least listen and then come up with my own ideas. And what I realised is he's wrong. Now, he's not wrong because I'm right, but when I took the opportunity to unpack it and think it through, then I was allowed to say, yeah, he's wrong. For example, he said your home's not an asset because it doesn't bring cash flow in. He said, I've got three homes and they're a liability, but I have 8,000 investment properties and they bring in cash flow in, so that's an asset and my home isn't. What else do you invest in, Robert? I invest in gold and silver. And I was courteous enough not to disagree with him too much, but gold and silver doesn't bring money in. So his definition of an asset is something that brings cash in when he wants to talk about real estate, but not when he wants to talk about other things. So it was interesting. So I guess the point I'm making is who do I listen to? I actually read a lot. I don't read books. I don't read fiction. I do enjoy every night turning off and watching TV. And Pam and I have just been enjoying watching The Blacklist with James Spader and getting involved and excited in fictional sort of stuff. I read as much as I can is people, ideas about the economy, about finance. And one of the other economist that I like a lot in Australia is Christopher Joy, who writes for the Financial Review. I very much respect his opinions. I listen to other people's podcasts. My opposition is one as well. I'm still learning every day. If I haven't learned something new every day, I think I've had a bad day, Peter.
Yeah, and you're on the slow grey line to your inevitable demise. You've got to keep learning and growing, don't you? Either green and growing or you're brown and dying.
Well said.
Tell me, have there been any particularly dark periods on your business journey, you know, when it was really hard to sort of drag yourself out of bed and, you know, how did you break out of those kinds of funks?
Not in my investment journey, I guess in the 90s when I ruined my first marriage and had to restart my life again, I had some dark times. In business, though, I think the things that got me down the most were in the early days, there was a number of internet forums, and as you stick your head up and start to give advice, there was, I think, the tall poppy syndrome. People said, no, yes, you couldn't. Because as you said, my advice has been contrary to what others have said. But already then I'd had 20 years of experience in this, so I brought more perspective. Today, I don't participate in those much anymore, but what I do have is a big presence on YouTube and Instagram and other things. And YouTube, there are a few trolls who follow me regularly and leave comments, and they make it used to annoy me until I recognized that one of the signs of being successful is actually having people knock you, complain, disagree with you. And it doesn't annoy me as much anymore. I somehow or other feel a little bit sorry for them, recognizing that why they're probably knocking me is because I've achieved what they would have liked to achieve but haven't. And so it's easier to run those other people down than to try and get up there.
Yeah. Usually once you start getting people knocking you, you know you're on the right path. My 17-year-old daughter has been a YouTuber since she was 13. She built up to 140,000 subscribers, and she had to deal with trolls en masse as a young girl.
That's hard.
Teenage daughters can be horribly vindictive creatures, and I'm astounded at how well she weathered it and the grace with which she handled it. She never bit back. She never engaged with people like that. And yeah, I got enormous respect for that girl for the way she dealt with it. I actually wrote to one of her detractors once in the public forum of YouTube, and I thought long and hard about what I would say. And ultimately it came down to what you just said, that I felt terribly sorry for her, that she felt the need to pull down or tear down somebody who had who was loved and respected and admired by a lot of young girls. And that she probably needed to spend a bit of time looking at herself in the mirror and having a good talk to herself about where this is coming from, you know. Yeah, it's the stuff that kids have to deal with, our kids have to deal with, yes, now compared to what we dealt with. It's very different, isn't it?
Very much so.
So tell me, Michael, where do you feel most inspired? Where you mentioned that you liked to work from home from time to time when you were feeling creative a couple of days a week. So where do you tend to feel the most inspired and creative?
There's, I think, two times. So I do work from home and I do write a lot. So my hobby is my job, my work. I write, I produce a lot of material, books, podcasts, articles every day. And on the basis of that, the best time really is I'm most productive in the morning. So I actually get a lot done in the first couple of hours of the day. The other time, Peter, I'm very creative and productive is on vacation. So I don't fully turn off. I think when I'm away from the normal environment, and we tend to go on cruises a lot, my wife Pam has now learned that Michael needs an hour or two a day to work on his computer, and that's when she does her photography and things like that. But while I've got the ability to not worry about the day-to-day things, my mind's always thinking of new ideas, and then I've got to put them down and not necessarily work on them at the time. So I'm also creative when I'm in a different and a new environment. So that's part of the fun of going on vacation for me, Peter.
Yeah, I totally agree. I relate to that so much. I find myself most inspired in a hotel room, preferably with a bay window, looking out over a gorgeous view from an elevated position. and that and an aeroplane window seat. For some reason, those two things always inspire me, and I think really big thoughts, and I make some huge plans. Mm-hmm. My last trip to Bali before the lockdown, you know, I came up with a whole construct of where I wanted to take my business, what mattered to me, who I wanted to, the changes that I sought to make in the world and all this sort of stuff. Mm. And I was very inspired. So I certainly relate to that. So looking back on your life now, and you've got plenty more life ahead of you, but looking back at this point where you are now, what are one or two things that you used to care about when you were younger that you realize just aren't important anymore? Because you've got the benefit of perspective now and wisdom.
Well, I guess one of them is what other people think, and we discussed that a little bit before. Of course it still hurts a bit, but nowhere near as much, interestingly. In fact, it hardly hurts at all because I now feel sorry for them. I think the other thing is I was very much driven by money and possessions in the past. I still like my possessions. I still like my toys. I still like my cars. It's not as important to me. Now as I'm saying that, I wonder, is it not as important because I've got it? If I didn't have it, I'd probably think it was important. It's nothing. I've actually understood that true wealth isn't really how much money you've got. I also have the confidence that if I lost it all, that I'd get back again. So I don't have the insecurities that I had for the first half of my life. I was, I think, driven very much by insecurity when I was young.
Mm, ditto. I think you're just an older, better-looking version of me, Michael. Better-looking and richer than me. So much of what you say about your past echoes mine. So if you knew that you just had a decade to live and well, actually, I wanted to ask you the other question first because the other side of the coin to, you know, what isn't that important anymore is what does matter most to you these days?
Well, one of the things I've recognized is the importance of gratitude, as I've said. So each morning I sort of wake up and I try and remind myself. I don't do affirmations and I'm not into woo-woo stuff, but I do like to think of what I'm grateful for and start off on a positive note. At the end of the day, I think, what are the three things that were really good today? And the ones that keep coming every day, what the good things were, the time I spend with my grandchildren. So even during the lockup, three times a week, we're spending time on Zoom, watching videos or watching cartoons. Lately, we've been just showing them funny things like optical illusions on Zoom and just relating with them. In my blended family, I've got 10 grandkids. But fact, family, friends, my time with my wife. So if I had to put number one on the list, it would be my grandchildren. And number two, my children, because just in case they're listening to this.
Okay. All right.
Glad my wife's number one. Better get the order right. Never know who's going to listen to this.
Do you want to do that whole thing again?
No.
So, all right. So let's end with this. If you knew that you had a decade left to live, and I hope that you've got at least a few left in you, but if you knew you had a decade to live, what legacy would you like to leave behind? Like, what will your kids and your grandkids consider to be your dent in the universe?
Well, I think there's a different thing between the legacy for I'd leave behind and what my kids and grandkids would leave. So I'm really, really proud that my first book, How to Grow a Multi-Million Dollar Property Portfolio, is on the bookshelf of most successful property investors. I'm really, really proud of the fact that I've probably educated more successful property investors than anyone else in Australia. Easy to say because I've been doing it longer than most, but also from the results I've seen. I hope I'm going to leave a legacy of financial literacy and more wealth for more people. Again, it's the comment I made earlier on that now that I've achieved it, I believe it's my responsibility to help others as well. So that's one of the legacies I'd like to leave behind. Interestingly, in a number of the suburbs in Melbourne that we drive through, because of the large number of property developments we've done for ourselves and for clients, there's two or three suburbs which I've actually done 30, 50 medium density developments and left a physical legacy as well. And my kids will often, as we drive past, say, hey, is that a Metropole property? That looks like the sort of stuff you'd normally do. So there's a legacy for the larger community, for the local community. And for my kids and grandkids, I hope what I've left them is a level of security that I didn't have as a child or as growing up of unconditional love and support.
They sound very, very profound, both of those. I relate to both. My dad was a builder his whole life, built his parents' house when he was 14, worked his butt off as a builder for 50-odd years, never had a business card, never ran an ad, was always booked a year ahead. So he built his business on integrity and doing good work. And I love to drive around and see that's a house my dad built. Those shops there in Mount Eliza, my dad built those, you know, that kind of stuff. But he's also, like you just described, he's left a wonderful legacy in me in the time that he invested in me. We spent a lot of time camping, motorbike riding, sitting around campfires, talking about stuff, fixing things around the house, you know, playing cards till late in the evening, all those wonderful things. And those are the things that will really stay with me, mm-hmm. you know. So I think that the legacy that you're leaving behind from an outsider's perspective is a ripple effect that's going to go on multiple generations. I believe that my greatest legacy is the impact I have on my kids, because that ensures perpetuity. That'll continue on. It'll filter through. And it's inevitable that some of the stuff that I pass on to them will become their principles and their beliefs and their practices, and they will continue to teach those. And that's what you've done. There are things that you've taught me that have stuck with me. There are behavioral habits, mindset changes that have occurred through consuming the stuff that you've put your heart and soul into producing over the last number of decades, you know. And that is already filtering through to my kids. You know, I teach them what you taught me. And as they see success in their own lives through investing, then that will continue to filter on through their kids and so on. So that's the legacy you're leaving behind, is certainty around being able to make wise decisions and to eliminate the number one cause of stress for most families, which is financial stress, through making wise decisions. That's what you've done. You know, I can't thank you enough for that, because it really is, as cliched as it sounds, life-changing when you get a really good mentor that sets you on the right track. And that's exactly what you've done for me and for lots of other people. So I'm very grateful to you for that. And I'm very grateful for the time that you've given me here today. I know you've got a ton on, and we've gone just over an hour. So I think we should wind it up. What do you reckon, Michael?
Thank you. I appreciate it. I always have a fun chat. I'm talking about me. So why wouldn't I be having fun, Pete?
Now, there's lots of places that people can find you. You mentioned that before, but where is the best place for people to get into the into your ecosystem and to learn the stuff that you teach?
Well, if people are listening to a podcast now, they're probably enjoying podcasts. So the first place to go is the Michael Yardney podcast. And I'm really very proud of that. That's built a very, very big following, and I have a lot of fun, like I know you do, putting the podcast together. Every day there's a newsletter that goes out, property update to over 100,000 people. We've got a very large following of talking about success, money and property, so propertyupdate.com.au. Or you can follow me on social media, just Michael Yardney, and the team that I lead, Metropol, are advisors in helping people grow, protect and pass on their wealth. But if you listen to my podcast, go to Property Update, you'll find out all about Metropol as well, Peter.
Mm. And Property Update, the website,
propertyupdate.com.au.
That's the top property investment advisory website in the world, isn't it?
I have been really proud that for 4 years in a row, FeedSpot, which is an American-based organization, has ranked us the number one property website 4 years in a row. And that's worldwide, not just in Australia. And that includes Google Property News and the big newspapers and everybody else. We've so far this mm-hmm. year had over 650,000 individual readers to that. So that's not just page views. So last year there was 1.5 million individuals reading it at some stage of their life. That's touching a whole lot of Australians, and I'm very proud of that achievement.
Mm. Well, it's going to be reaching US people too, because actually a large portion of the people who listen to this podcast and come to the Office Anywhere website are actually from the US. And the good thing about advice from someone like you is, you know, Aussies call a spade a spade. They don't stuff around. You don't get any rah-rah stuff here. So the kind of advice, if you're a US citizen listening to this podcast, the kind of advice you get from Michael Yardney, 99% of that is applicable to you in the US as well. And it's straight talk built on decades of experience. So you'd be wise to go there and have a look and read some of the sort of stuff and listen to the sort of stuff that Michael delivers.
I think one of the things that differentiated us, Peter, as we're talking about it, was while a lot of other people talk about real estate, when I understood the psychology of success, that changed my life and then also the life of our clients. So therefore my podcast and my writings, while some of it is fact-based and important, and that may not be as relevant for overseas, the psychology of success, why some people are going to be successful wherever they are, that doesn't change. That's universal. And probably my most successful book, Rich Habits, Poor Habits, has now been translated into 5 languages because the psychology of success of the habits of the rich people, which are so different from the average person, has been picked up in Poland, in China, India, Vietnam. It's funny seeing the covers of in the different countries and the words on the front and don't understand what they are, but I assume they've translated them right.
Yeah, let's hope they're not offensive. I have seen some funny translations in the past. Anyway, look, it's been great talking to you, Michael. It's like any of our other conversations that we've had. It's always enjoyable. I always feel energized after chatting with you. I think we'll leave it at there.
My pleasure.
Appreciate your time, and I look forward to chatting to you again, Michael.
We'll speak soon.
And that's a wrap. Always like chatting to Michael. He really is kind of like, you know, that crusty uncle who has done a lot, seen a lot, achieved a lot. But if you're not paying attention, he'll stop giving you advice. We've had a couple of lively conversations over the last couple of years, particularly in the last 6 months, where he's delivered a bit of brutal honesty to me, which is always appreciated, especially from somebody who has the credentials to give it. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this conversation. If there's one thing that I want you to take away from this chat with Michael is, well, two things really. I think the first thing is to recognize that you really can be financially successful. It's not particularly complicated. It's not a mystery. It's definitely not a secret how to get there. It requires the application of time-honored principles, delayed gratification, spending less than you earn, all the things that Michael talked about, and then making sure that you take advice from people who have done what you set out to do or what you're setting out to do and who don't profit disproportionately based on the selections that they push onto you. And the other one is to play the long game because, as I've said so many times, things don't happen quickly in the beginning. Things take a while to take root, to build. And momentum can feel very slow in the beginning. And this is why a lot of people just never really build up a substantial nest egg, a financial nest egg, because they're too impatient, because they don't see the results straight away. But as I've said before, if you look at the wealth graph for Warren Buffett, you'll see that for years it just looked like it was flatlining, just going up a little bit. And then the exponential growth, the hockey stick effect came in. And it just skyrocketed. And this is so often the case. I mean, you look at with real estate, for example, that typically well-placed real estate, at least in Australia, in metropolitan areas, investment quality grade properties, will tend to double in value every 7 to 10 years. Sometimes it's less, sometimes a little bit more. But each time it does that, it's doubling off the previous doubled amount. And so in the beginning, it doesn't seem like it's doing much. But as time progresses, it grows rapidly. So those are the two bits of advice. Recognize that you can become financially successful. You can become wealthy. And the second is you've got to play the long game. There's just no two ways around it. You have to play the long game. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this. You can find the post that goes along with this over at officeanywhere.co/108. And until we chat again next week, here's to working and living on purpose. Catch you then. See ya.